Good morning, everybody. This is The Other Side of Midnight on 77 WABC. I'm Frank Morano. One of the great joys in being on the radio is you get to call some really incredible people your colleagues. Now, we have somebody on this station on the weekends who was not only an incredible part of the economic revolution of the 1980s, not only an incredible part of the economic miracle that happened during the Trump administration, but somebody who is an expert on almost everything. Even when I end up disagreeing with him, the way he explains things in a logical manner, an entertaining manner, and in a compelling manner makes you really feel foolish for disagreeing with him. And we're lucky enough to have him on the radio. You can see him on Fox Business every day at 4 p.m. and 7 p.m. He's the former director of the National Economic Council. He worked in the Office of Management and Budget in the Reagan administration. Gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome back to radio and welcome to this program the one and only Larry Kudlow. Larry, how are you? It's great to talk with you.
I'm great, thanks. Terrific. How are you, Frank?
I'm doing well. This is the first opportunity we've had to chat since you've returned to WABC, where you belong, and since you've returned to the private sector from your time in Washington in the Trump administration. I'm wondering, I know how much you enjoyed your life in the private sector, being on radio, being on TV. It was one of the factors that led you not to run for U.S. Senate in Connecticut. We talked about it at the time. I'm wondering if you can tell folks a little bit about your decision to join the Trump administration. You had a great life. You were doing a lot of interesting things. What made you decide to go back and answer the call to public service?
Well, that's an interesting question. First of all, I would say to you, when a president calls, you should answer. I think that's a key part of public service. I've done it before, and I did it again. Secondly, I like Donald Trump a lot. And I felt that he would be a supply sider, cutting taxes, cutting regulations. And that's right up my alley. And I felt that he was going to shake up Washington. He was the right guy at the right time to shake up Washington, to drain the swamp, as he put it. So I had worked on the campaign and helped him develop his tax policies and other issues, regulatory issues, monetary issues. So at first I told him I didn't want a position. It's funny, beginning 2017, but when he called me in early 2018, I felt that I could play a role at the National Economic Council. And so it seemed like a good fit at the time, and it was three great years, actually, three great rails, kind of a job of a lifetime. You're in and out every day with the boss. You run a staff. The National Economic Council is a very powerful staff. Sit on the National Security Council also. So I did it, as I say, job of a lifetime. Very grateful for it, and get a chance to serve your president, serve your country, and put some of my own ideas into effect.
As much as you are certainly in lockstep with President Trump on a better business environment, fewer regulations, lower taxes, I used to listen to you on the radio when President Trump was running, and there were some key policy differences. I mean, the two that most immediately come to mind are on immigration and on issues related to tariffs. And I wondered, when you and Steve Moore became some of the president's leading advisors on policy, and then you became the leading economist for the president in the whole country, I'm wondering how those differences in policy manifested itself into governing. A lot of folks I know were concerned that it could be another John Bolton kind of a situation, where Bolton's differences on policy had really destructive consequences. But you guys seem to be able to work together in a pretty collaborative manner. What's the key to working with a president that you might differ from on some policy issues?
Well, look, you're not going to win every time. You go in understanding that. There's no sort of pluperfect way. I won a lot. I lost a few. But it's funny, on trade, I oppose his tariffs on steel and aluminum. And to this day, I've never endorsed them. And he knew that going in. So when that occasionally came up, I said, well, I don't agree with the president on this. And then I'd move on to another subject. And that's the way it works. The one thing I did agree with him on trade, though, first of all, the USMCA deal, the so-called NAFTA 2, I was a strong supporter of that. That was a pretty good trade deal. Not perfect, but pretty good. I worked carefully and closely with my very old friend, Bob Lighthizer, who also worked during the Reagan years. And I especially, we had Japanese free trade deal. We had South Korean free trade deal. So I approved of all that. And the one that I might not have thought about so much, but the China trade, we hammered out a deal. But I felt that we had to be, that President Trump was correct in his viewpoint that China was cheating. They had a number of tariff and non-tariff barriers. They were stealing our intellectual property. They were forcing us to give up our technology secrets to them, so-called transfer of technology, forced transfer of technology. So I might not have agreed with every tactic, but I felt that we had to be tough with China. And so to some extent, I agreed with him when the tariffs were necessary to bring them to the negotiating table. And again, I might not have agreed with every tactic, but I felt the cause was correct. And I think as events worked out, China is, I don't know if they're our complete enemy, but they are certainly a competitive adversary. They're very difficult, not only in trade, but in other things, military, human rights, Uyghurs. What they did in Hong Kong was an absolute disgrace. And what they may do in Taiwan is something. So I felt that I was at one with him on the China trade issues. Really, the only place I disagreed was the steel and aluminum barriers. And the other one is on European trade. We never did get a deal. I worked very hard on European trade. Sometimes the president wanted to slap tariffs on them, but I and some others helped talk him out of that. So that's an unfinished agenda item. We still have many, many differences. On the other hand, British trade with Brexit, we supported Brexit. I supported Brexit before I was in office. So I had actually rather few disagreements with him on policy issues.
Well, it sounds like President Trump did the impossible, which is he converted Larry Kudlow on an issue because I used to listen to you on WABC Saturday mornings on immigration, and I'd listen to you go at it with the callers, and you were an open borders guy. It sounds like the president may have won you over.
Well, on that, I had become less open borders before I went in. But what I saw was this incredible rush of illegal immigrants crossing the border. In effect, we didn't have a border. And that was a subject that I hadn't focused very much on. Remember, Frank, I always felt that legal immigration, adding a million or a million plus workers a year, was a good idea, but it had to be legal. And over a period of time, I came to see the difficulties. I think we needed to strengthen our border. So I suppose in that sense, I did change my mind. I adjusted to what was the reality on the ground. I mean, you know, you're looking, you know, you're sitting there in the White House and you're watching events play out. And literally, people were just walking in with this crazy catch and release policy that, frankly, I never approved of. But we had a very good, I might say, we hammered out a very good trade proposal, which included making a lot of illegals legal, people who had lived here for 20 or 30 years, or maybe less. I heartily approved of that. We wanted to change it from a family chain migration to a skills-based, merit-oriented legal migration. So I approved of our basic immigration policy. But yeah, I felt over time that that border had to be closed and that we just couldn't handle the freight. And so, yeah, that probably was a change in my thinking.
We're talking with Larry Kudlow. You could see him on Fox Business every weekday. You can hear him on this radio station every Saturday morning from 10 to 1. My last question about your service in Washington, Larry, and then I want to ask about what President Biden is proposing these days. But you served in the Reagan administration in the Office of Management and Budget. Then you certainly served in the Trump administration, where your role nationally setting economic policy and advising the president is well known. I'm wondering, how would you characterize the difference between serving a Republican presidential administration in the 80s versus serving one in the 21st century? What were the key differences? What were the similarities?
Well, of course, they're two different people on a personal basis. They're just different kinds of people, but their policies were very similar. I mean, that's the interesting thing. I guess I'm one of the few links between Reagan and Trump, even to this day. There are a few others, as I said. Bolton served with both, and Lighthizer served with both. And there were others, perhaps lower down. But on policy terms, remember, both Reagan and Trump slashed taxes.
And both, your next book might have to be JFK and the Trump Revolution.
Well, that's right. It really went from JFK to Reagan to Trump. And both presidents, by the way, slashed regulations. Reagan was a great believer in overturning regulations, as was President Trump. So there are a lot of policy similarities. And both believed, incidentally, in a very strong military, just as Reagan rebuilt our military, so did President Trump. We put about, in the Trump years, we put about $2.5 trillion into the defense budget. So there are great similarities on that front, too, making America strong. And Reagan didn't use the phrase America first, but, you know, in his battle with communism, it certainly was America first. And with President Trump, who I might add wiped out ISIS in Syria and forged a tremendous new Middle East policy called the Abraham Accords, which cut out Iran. Iran's not the Soviet Union, but Iran is certainly a very bad place, and instead made peace between the Arab Gulf states and the state of Israel. And so we reworked the map there. So there are remarkable similarities, in my view, regarding the policies of the two gentlemen.
And in terms of practice and style, I would imagine the social media era of 2017, 2018 plays a very different role than it did in the early 1980s, when social media was non-existent, where you weren't waiting on pins and needles for a Reagan tweet.
Well, that's right. Reagan would have been a great tweeter, by the way. But
I can imagine.
Here, too, both gentlemen had the view that the mainstream media would not give them a fair shake. And Reagan wanted to go over the heads of the mainstream media in the New York-Washington corridor. And he did so through a number of press conferences. Both of these guys, you know, had a lot of press conferences. I think Trump more than Reagan, but Reagan had quite a few. And then Reagan used to appeal to the regional editors and publishers and news stations as another way of getting over the heads of the mainstream media in the Washington, New York corridor. And Trump knew full well. And Trump was very effective. And I thought it was a very powerful weapon.
You got to give me your take on President Biden's joint address to a joint session of Congress, and specifically his infrastructure proposal, his multi-trillion dollar infrastructure proposal. I've been listening to you talk on the radio about it and seeing you a bit on television analyze it. And needless to say, it's something you're not exactly enthusiastic about.
No, I mean, I think it's a very bad approach, and it has only very little to do with actual infrastructure, roads, bridges, tunnels, and so forth. And so they're trying to redefine infrastructure in order to fit a Democratic Party wish list. First of all, it's always been a Trojan horse for the Green New Deal, which I think would be a disaster for this country. Second of all, it was a Trojan horse for class warfare. Tax hikes on corporations and successful individuals. It's an assault on investment, which, if it's implemented, will also have a very bad impact on the economy. And third of all, on social policies, this idea of a social infrastructure, which I've never heard of, as to this day, don't know what the hell that means. But in terms of spreading and expanding welfare, great society type welfare, what they're trying to do is break the bond between work and benefits. The great deal in the mid-90s between Gingrich and Clinton imposed a number of work and educational requirements in return for some temporary or short-term benefits. And contrary to critics, that worked very, very well. Literally, millions of people came back into the workforce. Now, in this case, whether it's child tax credit or dependent care or health care, pre-K so-called, no work requirements for the parents are necessary. And that means, in effect, we are degrading the dignity of work. You know, we're sending it into a second or third class citizenship. And the volume of welfare and the time of welfare could go on forever. The volume is going to increase substantially. And I think that's a huge mistake, very demoralizing, I might add, for the workforce and the family and ultimately the country. So these are very bad policies. The taxes and the Green New Deal will decimate the economy, and the so-called social infrastructure will decimate the basic units of society. And I hope they all get beaten. I don't know. It's going to be a tough fight, but it's going to be a cost. It's going to cost a lot of jobs. You have a very, very strong economic boom going on now from the successful vaccination wave, which came from Trump's Operation Warp Speed. You also have a successful rebound because Trump's policies are still in place until they're repealed. You still have low taxes. You still have basically low regulation. You still have energy independence. So that's helping to spur it. Now, if these things get changed or reversed, as Biden seems to intend, it's going to have very harmful effects on the economy and jobs and wages, for that matter. The blue-collar middle class, which Trump built up so brilliantly, will be hurt badly. They bear the burden of corporate taxes. It's the middle class that pays the burden of any tax on large or small businesses or capital formation and so forth. And, you know, my adage here is, look, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. The economy is not broke. There's no crisis right now. There's no crisis. I mean, even the pandemic is not a crisis anymore. The economy is not a crisis. The house is not on fire, to characterize. There is no existential threat from global warming. I'm sorry. The volumes and issues here from man-made carbon emissions are very, very, very small and have over 100 years virtually no impact. And so I wouldn't mess with it. And I think the Bidens want to mess with it. They hate Trump. They still suffer from Trump derangement syndrome. But in economic terms, it's going to be very damaging. And you're going to have a great year now, this year, as we move from pandemic to reopening. But if this stuff gets legislated, you're going to see a big slump in 22 and maybe beyond.
We've heard a great deal of criticism from some Republicans in Congress and some conservative policy experts around the country, indicating that they're concerned with the amount of spending in the infrastructure bill and some other the Save American Jobs Act, the COVID stimulus bill, a number of aspects of key Biden administration initiatives. In your view, have the Republicans in Washington lost a little bit of credibility on the spending issue by continuing to go forward with increasing spending under both the Trump era and the Bush era in those years where there was a Republican administration, even while pursuing tax cuts? Why should we listen to the Republicans now when they say spending is becoming dangerously out of control?
Well, I don't know. I mean, Biden's first year, he's gotten $2 trillion already. And he's proposing another $4 trillion. That would be $6 trillion. That's got to be a world record, Frank.
I would think you're right, but I'll defer to you on that one.
I'll acknowledge that the GOP could be tougher on spending, but this is really off the charts. My hat's off to him. $6 trillion in 1 year. That's on top of the $4 trillion that would naturally happen in the budget itself. So this is, you know, $10 trillion. That's a great number, man.
Fighting a world war that we don't know about. It could be preparing for spending for another world war that we're not aware of. Finally, Larry, I have to ask you about the decision yesterday, or depending on how you look at it today, of Facebook's oversight board to uphold Trump's Facebook suspension. It seems like one of the issues that liberals and conservatives are somewhat united on is their antipathy towards the big tech companies. A lot of people on the left are concerned about the monopolies and the monopolistic nature of some of these social media companies. A lot of conservatives are concerned about the level of censorship that seems to be going on at these big tech companies. As a policy issue and an economic issue, what's the proper role for regulation of these big tech companies?
Well, there has to be additional regulation because they've abused their common carrier status that they were awarded back in the mid and late 90s. So they're really acting as publishers and editors. And the practical impact of that is, as you say, conservative censorship. And that can't last. They have no business doing that. So when I was in Trump administration, the president felt this very strongly. We would have either eliminated the so-called Section 230, which provided a liability shield for these companies as common carriers, but now that they're self-imposed newspapers and editors, that should go, and they should be subject to lawsuits, anything liable. And one of those lawsuits, I think, is consumer damage because of the wipeout of conservative tweets and so forth and postings. And that includes not only Facebook and Twitter, it includes YouTube, and it also includes Apple, it also includes Google. So I think you should probably have an antitrust investigation, which is coming, I think, from the at least we started it in the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission and the Federal Communications Commission. And I think that in this case, the low-hanging fruit is a complete change from that Section 230, which was originally, you may recall, a decency act. With respect to crazy stuff like child porn, it's going to have to be extended now. And these media outlets can't just moderate as they see fit. You're either public, as in the case of a common carrier, or you're going to face charges, you're going to face lawsuits and so forth. Mm. And you're not going to be shielded from that. So I think all of that is coming. The tech companies, they're already a little bit on the run, but much more has to take place, much more.
Larry, it's great to have you back on the radio. During the 3 hours that you're on every Saturday morning, John Catsimatidis and I are trading text messages, praising the work that you're doing, whether it's your interviews with people like Ben Carson, your insightful commentary when you're talking to folks like Michael Goodwin, or giving your own monologue, or the fact that you're willing to mix it up with some people on the other side of the political aisle and always discuss these issues in a civil manner, but in a way that gives proper deference to all points of view. It's a real treat to be able to call you a colleague, and it's an even greater treat to be able to listen to you again. And best of luck with everything you're doing. Looking forward to many conversations like this in the future.
Okay, Frank. My pleasure. Anytime.
If you want to comment on any portion of my discussion with Larry Kudlow, you're welcome to give me a call, 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead.